America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Thanks for coming back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. We've elevated the science that goes on in forensics labs almost to an unimpeachable science. Television shows make the conclusions found within these labs infallible, and their results the final word on who's exonerated and who's imprisoned. Our guest today, like in so many of our podcasts, rings the alarm bell on the thin threads of evidence represented by modern-day forensics. No matter how much CSI, NCIS, or Law and Order you've watched, enjoy all the drama. It's fun. But come here for the truth today on America Trends.
With me on the line is Brandon Garrett, and he's written a tremendous book called Autopsy of a Crime Lab, Exposing the Flaws in Forensics. Now, Professor Garrett, I know you're very distinguished in teaching at Duke Law School, but I watch television and I see how good these forensic labs are, and we venerate them. We make them to seem as if they are infallible. And yet in your book, you suggest just the opposite.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm a law professor, and, you know, early in my career, I even worked on cases of people who were freed by DNA testing. And my view was kind of like, well, you know, DNA testing is this incredible technology, and forensics are amazing. They unpacked how people falsely confessed, how eyewitnesses got it wrong. You know, forensics is uncovering error in our criminal system. But as I got deeper into that work, I started to learn how actually, well, for many of those people, problematic traditional forensics put them in prison in the first place. Even stuff that I just assumed was really solid, like fingerprinting, like firearms evidence.
Are you amazed at how fascinated we seem to be out here in the civilian world with forensics? What is it that captivates us in such a way?
I think, you know, going back to Sherlock Holmes, and certainly I was fascinated too in my own work. That's how I was gravitated toward these cases as a lawyer. The idea that science can solve human problems is incredibly exciting. And it really was transformational when all of a sudden we could do DNA testing and, you know, uncover ground truth in cases that were decades old. We all know that human memory is fallible, and it's really hard to solve some types of, you know, even the most serious crimes. You know, the only person who saw the murder, maybe the victim, is dead. So the idea that we can uncover little traces and solve mysteries, it comes to this very human need that maybe we can finally get at the truth. Unfortunately, the folks who profess to be experts in our courtrooms for decades, they said, you know, we are the truth, we are the experts. We are infallible. We can match these little minute traces and tell you who really did the crime. And it turns out there was no science behind it all along for any of these disciplines. And it's been a real national scandal, unfortunately.
But I don't think a lot of people have picked up on the extent of this scandal. You start the book off with a case based on the most basic of these forensic tools, and that being the fingerprint. And the case of Brandon Mayfield, 100% certainty of a forensic match. What went wrong there? And so let's start from the simplest and get to more complex forensics.
Sure. And, you know, I thought fingerprinting was untouchable, that it was great. I mean, we look at our fingertips. There's all this detail there. It's incredibly detailed information. We've been told that it's almost like a symbol for individuality. You know, I told my publisher, like, I don't want fingerprints on my book cover. The whole point of this book is to dispel this idea that fingerprints, individual, unique, match. But what people often don't understand is, you know, there's a lot of useful information in fingerprinting. Like, there's something there. It's not like bite marks or some of these other junk forensics where it's not even clear that there's something there. But the problem is that the latent fingerprints, the hidden images that, you know, use dust or chemicals or whatever to lift from something at a crime scene, it's not going to be like a perfect pristine print, like when you roll a print for to get a passport or for a job or something, and they tell you, you know, roll it again, roll it from left to right smoothly to leave a really good image. Right. Obviously, someone who's committing a crime isn't going to really carefully roll their fingerprints so that every marking is transferred. Instead, there may be like maybe like 90-95% of it may be missing. And when you only have a little piece of the pattern, sometimes you can't even tell, like, is it a loop? Is it a whirl? Much less, like, what little details are there? And that was why Brandon Mayfield was one reason why he was ultimately falsely accused of being the Madrid subway bomber. He'd never even been to Spain. But there's a lot more there. Many of us assume that not only are fingerprints unique, but that these databases, they're computers. Computers are matching people, and it says match on a screen or something like that. None of that happens in the real and challenging work that fingerprint examiners do.
Well, you also tell us that the antiseptic world that we see on television, everybody's got the latest technology. Everybody seems to be so put together. And you're saying that's not necessarily the way these labs look in real life.
They don't get to wear leather jackets and sunglasses every day. Although, you know, we all like, you know, our jokes to be, you know, dramatized. Like, I'll never neg on that. Like, as a lawyer, like, it's great to have, you know, shows dramatizing the work of lawyers. It's fun. It makes it more glamorous when we do tedious work. And, you know, same thing for crime labs. We have great people who want to be forensic scientists now, including because the job has been glamorized on TV. So great. But in the Brandon Mayfield case, you know, so we might think that, oh, technology, good. Maybe human examiners can make mistakes, but technology. Well, it can actually be the opposite. So he was identified as a suspect in a database search. And there's, you know, well over 100 million prints in this interconnected system, this federal database. And, you know, the feds wanted to help the Spanish authorities in their hunt for whoever was responsible for this terror bombing. And there was a latent print on a bag of detonators. It was like a crinkly plastic bag. And so the print was not that great. There's a ton of missing information. If you're searching through a database with hundreds of millions of prints, the job of that algorithm is to come up with the prints that most look like what you have. So it's going to make the job more challenging, right? They're going to pick a lot of candidates that look a lot like each other. And for people all around the world who may have had no connection, like Brandon Mayfield, he'd never been to Spain, but they're going to pick prints from around the world that look a lot like each other. Or even if it's a state database, it's people all across your state who have prints that look as much as possible like each other. You know, his was the fourth candidate. You know, these algorithms don't give you a match. They give you candidates. And there really were a lot of similarities between, you know, the print on one of his fingers, this pristine print, and this thing from the crime scene, which you look at it and it's like all kinds of stuff, material from the dust that they used to get the print. Like, there's a lot of missing information there. And in fact, when they're going through their process, the number one FBI examiner identified a bunch of differences, like discrete differences between Mayfield's print and the one from the scene. But he found like 15 points that they had in common and thought, well, 15 points. I've never seen 15 points that didn't match. This is amazing. And two more senior or retired FBI examiners looked at it. That makes it a little bit more like a crime show. Normally, you're not going to have three experienced analysts all looking at it, but this is such a big case. They had three people look at it. There was circular reasoning, though. They were looking at the print from the bombing and Mayfield's print back and forth, side by side. And just in general, when you look at things side by side, that causes you to reinforce similarities. The FBI doesn't do that process anymore because of the realization that it causes bias. But there was other biasing information. Brandon Mayfield was a practicing Muslim, and they thought, terror bombing. Maybe he has a secret, you know, terrorist identity, even though there's no record of him going to Spain. You know, his daughter, they searched through the house and the computers. His young daughter had like a essay for school written about Spain. There's writing about Spain in the house. And that kind of contextual information may have biased them as well. Like Brandon Mayfield and his daughter have commented, like, if he was like a Maytag repairman or something, like then maybe he would never have been deemed a suspect. But instead, despite differences in the prints, three experienced, you know, you can't say these were inexperienced fingerprint people who didn't know what they were doing. You know, some of them had more than two decades of experience. They all concluded 100% identification. It is his print. His defense lawyer hired an expert who looked at what these FBI people did and said, oh, yeah, it's his print. Even the defense expert. But there was this confirmation bias. They were looking at the work of these other experts. And we're like, oh, look at all the points they marked. Wow, 15 points. But that just goes to show how much subjectivity there is in this analysis. There's no, like, they're not, like, measuring distances between things. There's no rule that if you have a certain number of points, the print must have come from the same person. There are no statistics. You know, normally you think that, well, if there are differences, there's 7 differences between these prints. That means it couldn't have come from him. It absolutely couldn't have come from him. But they discounted the differences, and, you know, it just goes to show that they're marking up stuff that's, you know, blown up on a screen. There's no science to it. It's not like DNA where they're calculating population frequencies. With DNA, you would never say it's a match or it's 100% identification. You actually, there's a statistic based on sound genetics.
With fingerprints, so you're saying in the book that with the exception of DNA testing, the experts can't give you a straight answer to the question, how reliable is your evidence? At least with DNA, they can give you that probability.
Yeah, these other techniques aren't probabilistic. I mean, blood typing is probabilistic. We know how many people are type O. We know how many people are type AB. But whether it's, you know, firearms or hair or all of these, it's a lot of what crime labs do is you're looking at these patterns. And what they're in effect saying is, you know, based on my training and experience, I've looked at a lot of prints. I've looked at a lot of shell casings. When I see this level of similarity, I'm sure they came from the same source. But how do they know? Have they been tested? In more recent years, when scientists have said, like, what is this? These people say that they're experts, but how good are they at their job? Have they been tested? When they've done these tests, they've actually found shockingly high error rates. It's not like Brandon Mayfield's case was the first time someone had got it wrong using fingerprinting. And when you give people serious tests, you find out that humans are fallible. And sometimes it's because the evidence is really low quality. Sometimes it's because they're not good at their job. We don't even know, like, do fingerprint examiners looking day in and day out? It's challenging work. It's tiring work. It's hard on the eyes. Do you get better after a couple of years of training? Do you get worse after doing the job for 5 or 10 years because your eyesight is shot and you're so used to people telling you, oh, you got it right. The person pleaded guilty, but you have no idea whether you did. We have no idea. What we do know is that the error rates when people actually have been tested are not like what people assume, like you and me. Like when we ask people, like, how reliable are fingerprints? They're like, well, they're unique. Like, the error rates must be 1 in 1 billion or 1 in 100 million. Well, like, it must be almost impossible to make a mistake with a fingerprint. And it turns out, no, it's like errors may be like 1 in a few 100 or more, depending on the situation.
Experts, you tell us, don't tell a judge or a jury about their own deep uncertainty. So let's get to these experts and let's get into court. And you know this situation well. What's really going on here? In other words, are they coming in as if they're coming from on high and that they are irrefutable and therefore we need to listen to them? And that in many ways, if we're looking at a jury, ultimately they will decide the case based on, well, what they assume is really expert witness and testimony to what happened.
Yeah, so for decades, you had different types of forensic experts coming in and literally claiming infallibility, which is a pretty amazing thing. Like, wow, not only am I an expert, but I'm perfect. I never make mistakes. They talked about a 0% error rate. The FBI certainly said that about fingerprinting and aggressively defended that. In 2009, when the scientific community came together with this report by the leading scientific organization in the U.S., the National Academy of Sciences, they sort of said it was laughable, the idea that, I mean, even using a ruler to measure something, there's an error rate because, you know, you may not line it up right. Like, any piece of equipment has uncertainty. It has to be calibrated right. And the idea that humans would be perfect at something that they do makes no sense. But these people claim to be perfect. And it certainly wasn't true, but it was also laughable from a scientific perspective. Actually, within weeks of the National Academy of Sciences report coming out, And all they did was point out the obvious. They didn't conduct some new study or new research, but the fingerprint community came together and said, okay, we won't say zero error rate anymore. We won't do that. But you still have these people coming into court, and they don't say, well, would they say, oh, well, the Brandon Mayfield thing happened. We know of at least one error. But, you know, I myself, I have never made an error. I've passed proficiency tests each year, which are super easy, meaningless tests for the most part. No one has ever told me I'm wrong. My personal error rate is zero. And by the way, I don't trust the studies that have been done in my field. You know, maybe those studies, you know, were too hard or something. And so you still have experts basically saying the same kind of thing, dancing around this issue of error. And judges haven't required anything of them. You know, judges are supposed to be gatekeepers. They're supposed to ensure, you know, experts are allowed to do something that regular witnesses can't do at trial. If you call someone as a witness as a lawyer, they're not allowed to give you their opinion. They can't say, oh, by the way, I have always totally hated the defendant. I think he's guilty. No, they can say what they heard. They can say, I saw the defendant doing something suspicious the day of the murder. I saw him, you know, with bloody hands running away from the scene. They can describe things they saw, they heard, they perceived. But they can't say, in my opinion, he totally did it. Experts can give opinions. That's unusual. The only reason we'll let experts give opinions is because they have special qualifications and skills and because they're doing something that we believe is reliable. We don't have an astrologer come into court and say, my opinion is, from looking at my crystal ball, that the defendant did the murder. We need to know that this person is actually an expert and that they are good at what they say they can do. And for that, we need to know how reliable the method is, and we need to know how good they are as a person. But in the past, judges let forensics experts in just on their sort of self-professed, you know, infallibility.
And by the way, who is paying these experts in general? I mean, is it the defense? Is it the prosecution? How do we know they don't have a vested interest to begin with?
Well, we know they do. You know, unfortunately, crime labs in the U.S. for the most part are not independent, and they're funded and are considered a part of law enforcement. Even some of the more independent ones, they don't even give their reports to the defense. They will give it to you as a defense lawyer if you have a court order, but not otherwise. You know, there are all kinds of terrible situations, like in Brandon Mayfield's case, but in other cases that we know of, where they were biased by, you know, pressure from, or sometimes even unconscious bias from detectives, from law enforcement. Sometimes just outright prosecutor calls and says, don't test the DNA. We don't want the DNA result. The guy confessed. We don't want to know anything else. But other times it's, you know, well, by the way, the prince you're looking at, this guy is a practicing Muslim, you know, he's a serious terrorist suspect. You know, there are very few labs that are truly independent from law enforcement, like you'd expect like a real science lab to be, like a clinical lab, where they're just independently looking at the evidence, focusing on the information they need to do the science right. There are very few crime labs like that. They are crime labs, not labs. And that needs to change. We know that it biases their work. We know that anyone is just understandably biased by the side that they work for. And there have been studies done showing that you give an expert the same information, you tell them it's from a defense lawyer, they'll shade their work one way. If you tell them this request came from a prosecutor, they'll shade their work another way. We all, you know, want to be part of a team and develop a team mentality. It's totally natural. It's not the fault of these experts. It's the fault of the system that they work in.
Autopsy of a Crime Lab. Brandon Garrett is with us. And this glorification that I talked about, I mean, despite the fact that lawyers, scientists, you tell us, and investigators are well aware of the full scope of the crisis that you bring out so vividly in your book. And I said at the beginning that I found it surprising, but I will tell you that here where I live in the state of Connecticut, we have venerated Dr. Henry Lee. He's been involved in many cases, including the O.J. Simpson case. And yet there are a number of cases in the state of Connecticut recently where his findings, many years later, have been overturned. I mean, new evidence has appeared, or the evidence has been considered to be faulty in some way, and people have been let free in recent years after spending significant amounts of time in jail.
You know, I don't know Henry Lee's work specifically. I know he's well known. I guess I would just say that in general, for any forensic expert, whether it's someone who's world famous like that or someone who works at your, you know, local police crime lab, that we should never be calling someone an expert because of their credentials. And I say that as a lawyer who teaches at a law school, and I'm producing credentials, and I hope my students, you know, do well because of their credentials. But there's a difference where a lawyer has a degree and they tell their client, like, look, I've research the cases. This is just my best judgment. It's different when a forensic expert says, these are my credentials, and what I'm telling you is the truth. We need to know objectively, how good are they at reaching the truth? How have they been tested? We would never, my favorite example is, you know, we would never let a courtroom translator start working in our courtrooms. A judge wouldn't allow the person. If they just said, look, I'm a native Russian speaker, I'm great at translating Russian, take my word for it. Everything I'm saying is perfect. I'm a translator now. The judge would say, well, we'll give you some tests. And by the way, even if you're a native speaker, does that mean that you can accurately translate in real time? That's a different task. It's hard to be a translator and quickly, you know, convey the meaning of something in Russian to English and back. We give them proficiency tests. We would never hire someone at the TSA to be an airport screener saying, I have a degree in airport screening. Trust me, I'll find the bombs. They're like, no. And we're going to test you, by the way. And they run fake bombs through the scanners to see if their staff can detect them because the stakes are really high. We can't afford mistakes. Our crime labs don't work that way. If someone says, yeah, I'm an expert, you know, I've taken some courses, I've looked at prints for a couple of years, you know, now I'm infallible. That's just It's not the way we should be allowing science in our courtrooms. And
well,
you know,
it is shocking. And I mean, the price of what we're talking about here is tremendously high. Of course, you have worked with the Innocence Project, and we know you say that FBI hair cases in 95% the FBI experts testified erroneously and misrepresented the reliability of the technique, including death penalty cases.
It was an enormous scandal, and the FBI deserves credit for actually looking back to see how often it happened. I mean, that's another thing that's shocking, that, you know, there have been over 300 people freed by DNA. There have been thousands of other people exonerated, not by DNA tests, in this country. But it's really rare for anyone to do an audit and to go back and find out how many other people were affected. I've just pulled, you know, random trials from the 80s and 90s to see whether the stuff I saw in these innocent people's cases was happening in other cases. And just like pulling random trial transcripts, I found all sorts of horrible testimony. I mean, one thing that haunted me when I was working on the book was one of the random trials. I just happened to have access to the Virginia Supreme Court archives at my law school library and just wanted to see, well, do you see some of the same people testifying? Because I know that they testified in innocent people's cases, and they got hair evidence wrong, and they got blood evidence wrong. They got everything wrong. And you could tell just from the face of the transcript. We're not talking about lab errors. We're talking about exaggerations in court. And I came across this case, which was just ludicrous bite mark testimony in the case of a man named Keith Harward. And it was just a random case. I had no idea whether he was innocent or guilty. It was just stood out as one of the many random cases that you could just read where experts said things that were unsupported, false. Well, it turns out around that time, he was writing his first letters to the Innocence Project in New York. DNA testing freed him several years later after more than 30 years in prison. It happened to be another horrible, horrible miscarriage of justice. And they're just all sitting there. You know, no one's keeping track of these cases. When the national scandal emerged surrounding this really, really over-the-top testimony that they give about hair, when everyone knew that people's hair is really different on their own head when you're looking at it under the microscope, it's one thing if you say, well, okay, it was a blonde curly hair from a crime scene. It couldn't have come from me because I have black curly hair. Fine. You know, the FBI, actually the Attorney General at the time, sent letters to all the states saying, you know what? Our FBI experts were training all of your labs, too. And we were telling you to say things that were wholly unsupported by the science. You should be looking at your cases, too, because this is a national scandal, and we played a role in it. We're sorry. Well, you know, in Virginia, the crime lab wanted to do an audit like that. They had no list of cases that involved hair evidence. They reached out to people like me, and I found, you know, like a dozen cases on Westlaw where they mentioned the hair evidence on appeal. But most cases don't have opinions on appeal. We only found 12 cases, and several of those involved really problematic testimony. But 12 cases? There must have been thousands, if not tens of thousands. And that's Virginia, where they immediately said, yes, we will do an audit. Most states didn't do that. And so, you know, we will never know how many tens, if not hundreds of thousands of cases involved flawed trial testimony. And then there's the work in the lab. What if they screwed up in the lab? We know what's happened in the innocent people's cases, but it's been really rare for any audits to actually occur to look back on how bad the lab work was in the past as well.
But it would seem inconceivable that people have not been executed based on bad science.
I think, in my view, it's inconceivable because, you know, we've had people come within days of execution who missed execution just based on random events, and bad science turned out to be one of the reasons they were falsely convicted and sentenced to death. You know, there's a case of Earl Washington in Virginia who came within 9 days of execution. He was intellectually disabled. The only reason he wasn't executed was that another prisoner who could, you know, write a brief, filed one on his behalf. He couldn't, you know, he could barely sign his name on his own behalf. But the lab reports in his case were altered. And we actually didn't, you know, learn about it until years later, until after he was exonerated, when civil rights lawyers uncovered the documents.
When we look at this, and I think you have demonstrated just in our conversation today, let alone in the book, that this is not just an exception to a rule. The rule is that this stuff really is highly problematic and questionable. But for someone who's listening, you have to understand that the entire Houston crime lab at one point was closed down for rampant errors. Now you tell us that they're developing a model down there. And then the case in my neighboring state still shocks me when I think about what some lab technicians got away with for years, and we're talking about 40,000 cases in the state of Massachusetts. I don't even understand, I'm not certain if you reported it in the book, how they unwound 40,000 cases.
that's another one of these unusual examples where they where old cases were actually reopened in response to large-scale forensics misconduct. There, it was analysts. It wasn't that they're coming into a court and saying, the hairs are a match, or never in my great experience have I ever seen hairs that are so similar, or the fingerprints, 100% certainty. There, it was sort of more simpler, like they were doing drug testing. And that, you know, there's some interpretation, the equipment has to be calibrated, but it is like a chemical test, right, that's based on sound science. And even that can go wrong. Well, there, you know, you had analysts that were actually taking the drugs themselves and were horribly addicted and weren't actually doing the tests. They were just faking the results and consuming the drugs themselves and were showing up at work, you know, completely high on multiple drugs every day. At two different labs in Massachusetts, this is happening. And the quality control at these labs is so often so terrible that no one noticed. They thought, oh, wow, these are actually model employees. They're doing their work so quickly. It's really quite amazing. Like, you know, I guess they were all taking amphetamines. Maybe that made them write up their fake reports really fast. The prosecutors are like, these are great witnesses. They're so confident. They always get the results we want. And the courts ultimately decided, look, you can't retest this stuff. They consumed a lot of the drugs. There's nothing left to test. We're just going to flat out reverse every case that they worked on, which was the right thing to do. But, you know, in other states, courts haven't done that.
Just remarkable. Let me go to that 2009 report that you talked about. And it said little impact, even as late as 2016, in terms of what they found in 2009 about unreliability. Scientists then, in 2016, came together with a simple message. If we don't know how reliable a forensic technique is, we should not use it until that fundamental question is answered. So here we are. We're speaking in 2021. What has happened?
There is better awareness that these are serious problems, but a lot of things haven't changed. There was just a statement, like a last sort of missive from the Department of Justice under the Trump administration. The Department of Justice issued a long, long memo saying, by the way, this report that included some of the leading scientists in the world from the White House Presidential Council of Advisors on Science and Technology in 2016, Dr. Eric Lander, who's he's been named as a cabinet member in the new administration. He helped to decode the human genome, leading mathematician and geneticist. Lots of other luminaries in the sciences were part of that report. And they said, look, years and years have gone by. The scientific community has come together to identify these problems in forensics. But the bottom line is, if you're not testing how good a method is or how good an expert is, then you shouldn't be using it in court. Instead, you test it, and you tell judges, you tell lawyers, you tell jurors how good the evidence is. It's that simple. It's nothing complicated. In the same way as if you're telling them about a measurement or someone's eyesight, you tell them what the score is, but you also tell them what the uncertainty is. Last missive from the Department of Justice in January said, well, you know, this is just wrong because there's no one way to measure error. It's wrong to insist on this reliability stuff because, you know, the work of, like, firearms examiners, it's so complicated. You know, there's so much subjective judgment involved. They're not really measuring things, like, you know, with a ruler or something. And, you know, different examiners have different levels of experience. The labs might have different procedures. And some firearms evidence might be, like, of better quality than other evidence. There are all these things that make the job sometimes more challenging, sometimes easier. So you could never, never actually know, you know, what the error rate is. I actually read everything in their memo as highlighting the problem. Like, yeah, if it's that subjective, if it's that variable, if it really depends on who you got as an expert and how good the firearm, the bullet or the cartridge is, that's exactly why we need to measure this stuff. That's actually terrifying, all these reasons why you say error rates are impossible to know. It's exactly why we need it before we let any of this stuff in court. And it's not hard to do. You can give people tests in their daily jobs, just like they do in, well, real laboratories, like clinical laboratories.
In that 2009 study, there was a lot of forensic evidence used in criminal cases without any meaningful scientific validation, as you discussed. Even Justice Scalia, you tell us, said, we're not immune from the risk of manipulation. How much have we moved so far because of the veneration, the glorification of forensic science as part of our criminal undertakings and pursuit of justice? How much have we really given up in the courtroom to this expert testimony that, in fact, is unreliable, that is inconsistent, as opposed to the old gumshoe approaches that somebody really kind of figures it all out through a process of deduction? How far have we gone in this direction, and can we come back from it
Or are we so excited mm-hmm. by what we see on television that this is not going to go away? And it doesn't seem as if the reforms are coming anytime too soon.
I mean, I think the good news is that, you know, I've surveyed now like tens of thousands of mock jurors, people playing the role of jurors in criminal cases. And, you know, people really do want to know, like, how good is the evidence? People aren't necessarily, like, swayed by an expert's persona and their credentials and things. And if experts really do say what the limitations of their evidence are, like, jurors don't say, oh, my goodness, fingerprinting isn't perfect, I'll never convict someone again. They take that into account in a rational way. Like, the sky won't fall if we present science in a careful way to jurors rather than this, I'm infallible, the evidence is perfect. I mean, that kind of... That made-up testimony that experts gave for so many years, it wasn't necessary. People trust their doctors when their doctors say, look, there haven't been enough studies done on this treatment, but I do think it's the best one available in my judgment. These are the risks involved. These are the advantages. This is what I'm counseling you to do. You might want a second or third opinion. Right? We can process it, right? We have to. And, you know, forensics, if they're conveyed with the appropriate limitations and humility, can provide really, really useful evidence. And that said, you know, the other types of gumshoe evidence, I mean, I do a lot of research on eyewitness memory and on false confessions and on informant testimony. There's a lot to be said about the limitations of that type of evidence, too. In general, we need to view evidence with humility. It's all probabilistic. Eyewitnesses can be wrong. They're wrong a lot of the time. And forensics and scientific assays can really be of benefit to our system. Probably want to rely on, you know, science and technology when it's useful. You know, more than we do. Like, there's so much evidence that goes untested in criminal cases. But we need to have actually, you know, science involved in our crime labs and not just treated as, you know, we have some cops in lab coats, you know, producing the matches.
How careful should we be? Because you remind us that we are now in the era of big data forensics. Facial recognition is the next big one. And you finally described in the book for me something that was puzzling, why we can't smile on our license of photos.
But tell us
about privacy. And in this moment, for example, the gentleman that you started the book with and how he was ensnared, even though he wasn't in Spain, how many of us are in these databases now that we're collecting everything and often giving it up willingly? How much are we at risk that somebody's going to knock on our door, even though we were 4,000 miles from the scene of the crime?
Well, I don't know if we're necessarily giving it up willingly. You know, we willingly walk through an airport, but we don't realize that our photo is being taken and it's included in federal biometric databases. And we may not really have a choice if we want to live our lives, you know, whether to have a driver's license or not. Like, if you live in a place like North Carolina where I live, there's not a lot of public transportation, you need a driver's license. And, you know, my home state of North Carolina participates in the federal data bank, and so my driver's license photo is in that data bank. They tell you not to smile because it's easier for the algorithms to work on your face if you don't look cheerful. I always thought they just wanted you to look serious or something, I don't know, but no, it's for the algorithms. And you know, it's like being in a lineup every day of your life. You're always being searched. And it's not just, you know, photos. It's also the fingerprint data banks, DNA data banks. Increasingly, people are, you know, are DNA tested at the border and the like. It's the same kind of challenge like I mentioned for fingerprints. You know, you have a grainy image from a crime scene, kind of like a grainy latent fingerprint. And you're comparing that to millions of images of faces. And you're going to have a lot of faces that coincidentally may look like that grainy image. We don't know how reliable these algorithms are, and in fact, you know, there have been these inspector general reports at the federal level saying, like, why won't you actually test these algorithms to disclose how often they produce false hits or false misses? We need to know that if you're going to be using it, you know, on all of our faces. If you're going to be using our images, then you better be using it in a way that we have some confidence that's reliable. And it just hasn't been done. And you have these vendors marketing other algorithms where the same thing of unknown reliability and using images that we never gave permission. You know, there's a larger privacy problem that there are these huge archives that include lots of stuff that we might think of as private, but we don't have control over it, and it's no longer private. We don't have serious privacy protection in this country. But there's this additional problem that these algorithms are being used on the information that is of unknown or from what we know, poor reliability. And
well,
you know, technology may not make things better. Yeah.
Right. If your phone relies upon facial recognition or your fingerprint, and at times you can't get in, think about this conversation in that context. In closing, because we deal with social and political trends, you have a blueprint for fixing some of this stuff. But the question is, do you think we're moving in that direction? Is there a lot of umbrage, outrage within the criminal justice system as to the things that you document in the book so beautifully? Or are there desires for people to really make the changes that you're suggesting? And maybe in the context of your answer, you'll give us some of those ideas.
Scientists have been calling for years, like the National Academy of Sciences, that crime labs need to be independent. They shouldn't be an arm of law enforcement. And if we're going to use forensics, we need to do these foundational studies to find out how good they are. Some of them may just not be good enough to be used in court. From what we know, like the bite mark comparison stuff, so grossly unreliable, it just shouldn't be used. Other stuff like fingerprint comparisons, there's a lot of good information there. And in some cases, it may be really, really powerful evidence. In others, not so much, but we need to know. And third, like, who's going to do those studies? Who's going to set standards? We can't just leave it up to every police crime lab in the country. There's several hundred public crime labs. We need to have national regulations. There are very few states, even, that have, like, a state body that's sitting to decide, like, okay, what are we doing with forensics? Texas is actually a leader. They have a Texas Forensic Science Commission. And they've said things like, okay, we're not going to be using bite mark comparisons anymore. It's too unreliable. Or there were errors in the FBI DNA charts that we were given. We need to go back and figure out which cases DNA errors were made in with the statistics. And most states know nothing like that. And so we need a National Institute for Forensic Sciences. That's what the National Academy of Sciences recommended. There's legislation introduced. There's some concern. Nothing ever happened. So, we will see whether, we have federal regulation of clinical laboratories, right? If they're looking at slides to decide whether there's cancerous cells there, there's national regulation, there's serious testing. We want to know whether these people are making errors because they could miss a cancer case. We don't have that for crime labs. And it just shows how much we care about people charged with crimes versus people going to the doctor and asking for a medical test.
Very interesting. Brandon Garrett, I can't thank you enough. I think you've exposed something that very few people have thought a lot about, particularly when they sit down to watch one of 1,000 shows on television that do highlight and suggest the opposite, that all of this is going so well. Autopsy of a crime lab, exposing the flaws in forensics. Thank you for being with us today on America Trends.
Thanks for having me. Thank you so much.